Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week's Groundwire is produced at CKUW in Winnipeg. We're your hosts. I'm Jordan Poitras.
And I'm Ife Adigwe. In this edition, resistance to the Enbridge pipeline, Carla Ramirez, a whistleblower, is facing deportation, and how far can Shoal Lake's water go? But first, here's the headlines.
The debate on hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, heated up in Nova Scotia in January, as opponents held a provincial day of action called No Fracking Way. The province has granted Calgary-based oil and gas firm Petro Worth the go-ahead to do exploratory drilling near Lake Ainslie in West Cape Breton. Various organizations from Cape Breton have opposed this development and the possibility that the site may be used for fracking. Since the summer, Cape Bretoners have held at least five protests in the Canso Causeway that links Cape Breton to the mainland. And on January 15th, this was joined with a protest of 200 people in Halifax. Canadian regulations do not require companies to disclose what chemicals they inject into the ground during the fracking process, and no research has been done on the cumulative effects of fracking, according to federal MP Megan Leslie. Written by David Parker, CKDU Halifax, Nova Scotia.
CAW union members are blocking the rails in Ingersoll to protest the month-long lockout of Caterpillar workers. About 30 to 50 people are standing on the train tracks outside of the small southern Ontario town in front of a 140-ton new locomotive. This was one of the last produced in the electromotive factory before it was locked out. Caterpillar, who owns the company, wanted the workers of this plant to accept a deal which would have almost halved their wages and benefits. The union said no, and the management erected a fence around the factory on New Year's Day, locking out the workers. Since that point, 400 people have been essentially living without a paycheck. CHW was at the scene, and we talked to Paul Doner, an employee of the electromotive plant.
I mean, they keep asking for clawbacks. The clawbacks, the profits go through the roof. They're not hurting. Being a publicly traded company, anybody that in a period of 3 months pays their shareholders dividends, which is a small amount of the share, $300 million, has got money. It's ignorant, disgusting is what they're trying to do. And I mean, there are a lot of people that say we make excellent wages. That's true. So do a lot of other people. For what we're doing, we're building a world-class product. It's not a tinker toy or a dinky car. This thing's a major piece of equipment. It's the biggest inland industry next to shipping.
For Groundwire, I'm Ed von Outercast at CHW in London, Ontario.
The BC government is facing criticism for what it paid the authors of a report on the Stanley Cup riot. The report, titled The Night the City Became a Stadium, was widely viewed as soft on police, senior bureaucrats, and politicians. John Furlong, who served as CEO of the Vancouver 2010 Olympic Planning Commission, was paid $250 an hour. His original contract was for a maximum $70,000 in hours and $9,000 in expenses. After appeals to the government, his maximum fees were raised, and he was paid just over $88,000. Doug Keefe, a former Nova Scotia Deputy Attorney General, was also paid $250 an hour. His original contract was for a maximum $70,000 in billable hours and $40,000 in expenses. His contract was raised, and he was eventually paid a total of $131,000 in fees and $22,000 in expenses. His three round-trip flights from Halifax to Vancouver cost BC taxpayers over $14,000. Stuart Muir, a former Vancouver Sun deputy managing editor, was paid $150 an hour to edit and coordinate the report. His contract was for a maximum $18,000 with $5,000 in expenses. His contract was also raised, and he was paid a total of $25,000. Muir's name was in the news in November after a Victoria newspaper revealed he had been appointed a contract to serve as Vice President of Communications and External Relations for the Vancouver Island Health Authority on a one-year, $180,000 contract that was not advertised. Muir's contract was subsequently rescinded. The large payments have raised the ire of many British Columbians, who charged BC government officials and the author of the report with cronyism. Joel Bard, reporting for Groundwire.
Migrant people from Latin America, the Caribbean, and Southern Africa have been waging a hunger strike at a Niagara detention center, Sergio Puerto, Sandro Felipe, Jesus Galban, and Ibrahim Alifara have been detained for as many as 7 months. The strikers are demanding to be transferred to Toronto, where their refugee claims will be processed more quickly. The hunger strike began November 21st, but was paused after two of the jailed migrants hurt their back. Four protesters began a rotational strike on December 5th. They were then immediately placed in segregation. On December 20th, a solidarity rally was held at the Niagara Detention Center.
They've still been denied medical attention. The Canadian Correctional Guidelines for Hunger Strikes mandates that on the beginning of a hunger strike, a doctor is supposed to see every hunger striker to chart their medical history and their medical concerns throughout the hunger strike. Again, after 7 days, and then after 7 days, a nurse is supposed to see them on every single day. None of that has been followed whatsoever by the NDC.
Shame on the NDC!
Shame!
Following the rally, the strikers were moved from segregation and have ceased their hunger strike, but they remain imprisoned at the Niagara Detention Center, and none have been seen by a doctor. Some of the imprisoned migrants have also been denied legal aid. Legal funds are being raised by the Niagara Migrant Hunger Strikers Support Network. I'm Carly Forbes, reporting for Groundwire from Winnipeg.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. That was She's on Fire by The Noble Thieves from their album Beyond the 11th Deck.
Ed Von Andercas reports on resistance to the Enbridge pipeline from CHRW in London, Ontario, as the government begins a hearing on the Northern Gateway project.
With the demise of the Keystone Pipeline that was to have shipped crude oil from the tar sands in Alberta to the States, the Canadian government has been seeking to influence the hearing for the new Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline. Both Prime Minister Harper and Natural Resource Minister Joe Oliver tried to claim that opposition to the pipeline came from foreign-backed extremists. Oliver in particular said in an open letter, published to the press on the 11th of January, that it was foreign extremists that were seeking to disrupt Canada's trade and development through these environmentalist groups. I talked to Council of Canadians Energy and Climate Change Officer Andrea Harden Donoghue about what her view on the letter was.
To be frank, that open letter just made my head spin on a couple of levels. So let's just start with where this came from. If you look at Ethical Oil, the pro-tar sands blog that was launched based on Ezra Levant's work, they launched a campaign in the new year precisely on this topic. Lo and behold, we have Prime Minister Harper and Natural Resources Minister Oliver responding to that campaign. So number one, I find that quite disconcerting. Number two, I think it's quite interesting that they're really pointing the fingers at NGOs who receive U.S.-based foundation money, yet no questions are being asked about the influence of foreign multinational corporations and their interests being brought forward in this regulatory review. No questions are being asked about the millions of dollars being spent on lobbying the federal government or the close relationship between the federal government and the oil industry. And little is being said to recognize that this is one of the first times we've seen a huge number of people, concerned citizens as well as NGOs and groups, come forward and want to voice their opinions in a democratic process.
Mike Hudima of Greenpeace said that this letter allows the government not to hear unpleasant truths.
You have over 4,300 people registered to speak at this hearing. Most of them are from BC, most of them are local residents, and the Prime Minister and then now Minister Oliver have really attacked those voices and tried to say that they are foreign extremists rather than listening to their concerns, rather than hearing their issues, and hopefully making a different energy choice for Canada.
The letter came one day before the Canadian government opened hearings on the Northern Gateway project to determine whether they should go ahead with it. According to Greenpeace energy campaigner Keith Stewart, the government has tried to influence the hearings before they began.
And for a government to, before hearings process has actually begun, to say, the hearing is on, is this project in the national interest? And before it has even started, the federal government said it is in the national interest, and anyone who says anything different has to be some kind of radical from another country. There are a lot of people in BC who do not want to see a pipeline go through the Great Bear Rainforest. They don't want to see the impacts that would come from the oil spills that are inevitable. And they don't want tankers moving through some of the most dangerous waters in the country up a narrow strait where we've already seen major accidents.
And this is not the first pipeline proposed either. For years, the Canadian government with Congress were seeking approval of a pipeline which would draw oil from the tar sands all the way to the Texas refineries in the south, also known as the Keystone Pipeline. Despite the controversy surrounding the impact of the expansion of the tar sands and the potential for spills along the pipeline, the U.S. Congress were pushing for speedy approval. Unfortunately for them, President Obama kiboshed the project on Wednesday, January 18th, saying that there was not enough time left for reviewing the impact it would have on the environment. While Stewart feels that this is a step in the right direction, he says it's not the time to crack out the champagne just yet.
I will be glad to bid the Keystone Pipeline adieu. I don't actually doubt, though, that it will come back. TransCanada will probably make a new application for the pipeline. You know, it was a bad idea now, it'll be a bad idea then, and we'll be there to stop it again.
And as for the Enbridge Pipeline?
From Greenpeace's perspective, we need a national climate plan to actually achieve science-based greenhouse gas reductions. We don't see any way you can do that while increasing the output of the tar sands. And this project would, you know, export about roughly, you know, a quarter of Canadian oil consumption out to Asia. There's no way you can do that and achieve greenhouse gas reductions. You know, all of our best climate scientists are saying you simply can't do these types of projects and stop climate change. And we think if you're looking what's in the best interest of the next generation, we have to make that shift to a green energy economy rather than digging ever deeper holes in the tar sands.
For Groundwire, I'm Ed von Attercas from CHW Radio in London, Ontario.
For years, the city of Winnipeg has contemplated extending its water and sewage infrastructure to communities beyond the city limits in an effort to not only assist their neighbors with these coveted services, but also to secure a new stream of revenue at a time when the Prairie City is struggling to manage its finances. On December 14th, a motion to give the city's chief administrative officer the authority to negotiate water and waste services sharing agreements with West St. Paul and other communities in the so-called Capital Region came to the floor of City Council for consideration.
You'd be basically contributing to urban sprawl. And I would
Seven private citizens, most representing environmental or citizen advocacy core. Groups, expressed what concern that it's this extension of city services, even in exchange for monetary compensation, would jeopardize civic initiatives within the city core and contribute to one of the city's biggest challenges, urban sprawl. Chris Leo is professor of political science at the University of Winnipeg.
One of the main advantage that the city has in competing for development with adjacent municipalities is that it has a full-fledged municipal water and sewer system. Adjacent municipalities don't have that. In every other respect, adjacent municipalities have got the edge. Although they're a little bit farther out, they can offer more nearly rural kinds of living environments, and they offer much lower taxes. What we're doing is giving them the opportunity to still offer lower taxes, but provide the same water service that Winnipeg consumers get.
Brian Kelsey, a policy analyst and author of the blog State of the City, sees merit in the plan.
There's development happening in those communities anyway, and we don't have a say. We don't have a chip in that game. And being able to control service levels and offer those services actually gives us a very powerful tool to sit down at the province and those municipalities and say, okay, if you want our services, then you also have to take our input on planning that affects us. Right now, we don't have that say.
Chris Leo disagrees, pointing to the case of Detroit, Michigan.
After World War II, Detroit was a booming city. The downtown was really lively. They decided to start supplying water services to adjacent municipalities, and the rest is history. There's all kinds of development and prosperity to go with it in municipalities outside the boundaries of Detroit, and downtown Detroit is literally block after block of empty buildings and empty lots.
Opposition to the city's water services sharing agreement has also arisen from the source of Winnipeg's water. Shoal Lake, located 300 kilometers east of Winnipeg, is the source of Winnipeg's drinking water and has been since 1919. Shoal Lake number 39 is one of the First Nations communities affected by the diversion of water from the area via the aqueduct. After speaking to City Council, Band Councillor Leon Mandaman explained his concerns about the city's plans and the process that put it into place.
Our primary concern is that we have never been accommodated or consulted, and we've never been compensated fairly for the taking of water from our lake. The economic impacts for our First Nation are many. We lost a resource in fishing, hunting, wild rice. We're not on a lake anymore because of all the laws and that are in place to keep us in poverty.
I understand that the Shoal Lake 40 has a different arrangement.
We respect the deal that they have. The reason why we're exerting our jurisdiction is because we never gave our rights away to the lake bed. We don't want taxpayers' money. We want our resources.
On January 19th, the Winnipeg Free Press reported that the band was launching a lawsuit against the city of Winnipeg, demanding compensation for losses accrued by their community on the use and sale of water from the lake. Winnipeg Mayor Sam Cates had stated in a letter that the city had a right to extend its water and sewer pipes to neighboring municipalities and had no legal obligations to the First Nations community. Opponents to the deal can take some solace in the fact that amendments to the original plan mandate that service-sharing agreements with each new municipality must first be brought to council for consideration, although in the case of the deal with West St. Paul, which was approved in council by a vote of 11-5, well, that's all water under the bridge. For Groundwire, this is Michael Welch reporting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
K.P. Wee in Burnaby, B.C. reports on the struggle of Carla Ramirez, a Mexican whistleblower whose application for refugee status has been denied by Canada.
Carla Ramirez is a Mexican whistleblower, award-winning journalist and writer, who sought but has been denied refugee status here in Canada. She's applying to remain on humanitarian and compassionate grounds, and she recently spoke out during a press conference in Vancouver.
As a whistleblower, I have been treated, and also my family was threatened and received death threats. This is why I came to Canada in 2008. My refugee application has been denied, even when I have offered enough evidence to the Immigration and Refugee Board. I am one of the thousands of Mexicans whose cases have been denied by the immigration system. Just around 10% have been accepted. I am here in Canada now. My husband that is here. I am afraid for my life and my family's life, including my two Canadian babies. I am here far from my family, my roots, my profession, and the dream my daughters grow sheltered by their grandparents. I am afraid I will not be able to say bye to my parents if they are sick or dying, because I am fearful the people I have denounced will act on their threats.
One of Carla's lawyers, Lobat Hadrahashimi, speaks about her courage and her need to flee Mexico.
She worked as a journalist in Mexico at a federal government agency. And while she was working there, she discovered a major corruption scheme. Carla was the whistleblower and courageously went on to try and expose the corruption that she saw there, first within the agency, and when that didn't work, outside of it. In attempting to publish the evidence that she amassed about the corruption that she witnessed, she resulted in threats against Carla and her family. Carla's refugee case was decided in 2010. And in that case, the decision maker found that someone in Carla's position would be able to get protection in Mexico. And she also found that at that time, Carla hadn't published anything about the corruption that she'd witnessed, nor had there been any threats against her family since she'd been in Canada. Well, the situation for Carla is quite different now than it was at the time of her refugee claim. Since that time, Carla has published a book called The Talent of the Charlatans. And since that book has been launched, not only has Carla's family members experienced threats in Mexico, but Carla herself has received a threat. So her situation is very different than it was at the time of her refugee decision in 2010. Carla was able to file an application asking an immigration officer to consider the new risk to her since her refugee claim. And this application was denied in November of 2011.
Unfortunately, historically, 90% of Mexican asylum seekers have been rejected. That's because the Canadian authorities consider Mexico to be a safe and democratic country. Despite all of that, Shane Molyneux, another one of Carla's lawyers, feels optimistic about the appeal process.
We're waiting for a decision on the humanitarian and compassionate application, and we're waiting for a decision from the federal court on the appeal of the PRA decision, which was decided negatively in November.
So how hopeful are you that one of these will succeed, given the fact that, again, we've heard the track record with Mexican applicants?
Well, I'm optimistic because I think, you know, this is a strong case with strong facts.
Things became emotional during the Q&A session when Carla was asked to elaborate on the specifics of the threats that she's received.
After I tried to denounce in the senator's chambers, and they didn't do anything. After that, I had the first physical threat with a man that showed me his gun. And, you know, in Mexico, it's very common and it's very easy to pay a little money to a poor people, and they go to make the dirty work. And he said that I should be careful because if not, my body can be found in an empty lot, or that is worth someone of my family.
Several scholars and community leaders have come forward in support of Carla, issuing written statements supporting the fact that she's an outstanding contributor to our community through her volunteer work here in Canada. And everyone's hope is that she will not be deported. For Groundwire, this is KP Wee reporting from CJSF 90.1 FM.
That's it for the features. We'll be right back after this. That was Up the Mountain by the Crooked Brothers from their album, Lawrence, Where's Your Knife?
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. Leanne Arneson interviewed Aaron Lakoff, the coordinator of the upcoming homelessness marathon at CKUT in Montreal.
My name is Aaron Lakoff. I am the coordinator of the 10th annual homelessness marathon, woohoo, at CKUT Radio in Montreal.
What's the purpose of the homelessness marathon?
So I guess maybe to best describe the purpose, I'll just explain the history a little bit. So the Homelessness Marathon, it started in 2003 in Canada. It was modeled after a similar homelessness marathon in the United States, which got started a few years prior to that. And, you know, what happened is, you know, the early 2000s in Montreal was like a period of a really intense housing crisis. So you had many more people looking for housing than housing was available. And what happened is rent started to go up really fast in that period. It was also the beginning of the gentrification of a lot of neighborhoods of the city that had traditionally been working class, kind of low income, low rent neighborhoods. So we're talking about especially St. Henry. And so the installation of luxury condominiums for the rich along the Lachine Canal, neighborhoods like Petite Patrie, Hochelaga, Maisonneuve. So that was a period where there was a lot of very intense housing struggles in the city. Around the summer of 2001 or 2002, there was a large squatting action in Montreal called the Overdale Squat. So hundreds of homeless people and their allies went and took over an abandoned building, which is right near the Concordia campus on Overdale, and squatted it for about a week to demand that that building be turned into social housing. They ended up making a deal with the city. They got moved to another abandoned building in the kind of eastern part of the plateau on what was known as the Préfontaine Squat, which lasted for a few weeks until riot police came in later on in the fall and violently evicted everyone from the squat, and it never got turned into social housing. Ironically, that squat they were in on Préfontaine is now going to be torn down and turned into luxury condominiums. So the problem still persists today. And what happened after those squatting actions is Gretchen King, who is the founder of the Homelessness Marathon in Canada and the former news coordinator of CKUT, she'd been talking with a few of the squatters who were involved in those actions. And, you know, Gretchen, along with the squatters and some of the homeless folks who had been involved, said that it's so important that, you know, we keep homeless voices in the media year round, and that it's not just, you know, around Christmas time that we have homeless people in the media to say, if you drop a coin into the bucket of the Salvation Army, that's going to solve homelessness. So that's, I would say that's essentially the purpose of the marathon, is to ensure that, you know, homeless people are given the voice within the media that they deserve. And it's a voice that's so often taken away. You know, we have a very paternalistic way of seeing homeless people within the media that just says, oh, these poor people sleeping in the metros and on the streets, you know, if only someone could give them a hand up in our society. But we so rarely actually get to hear directly from those people themselves. So that's why every year we take our microphones, we take our equipment out into the streets in front of the Native Friendship Center to do this broadcast. So this year, like in previous years, it's 14 hours of broadcasting from sundown until sunup. We do the broadcast in Montreal from the Native Friendship Center. So definitely for people who are listening in Montreal, you're welcome to come down to the Native Friendship Center at the corner of Saint Laurent and Ontario for the whole night. And there's free food all night long. And it's just like, it's a really interesting space where people can come together, whether it's on the airwaves or off of the airwaves, to have these really important discussions.
How many stations across Canada are participating?
So right now we have, last time I counted, around 33 stations all across Canada confirmed, stations in almost every single province and territory, which is really exciting. So CKUT has always been kind of the main hub of the marathon, but this year, like in some years prior, it's very exciting that we have CKDU Radio in Halifax who's on board, and they're going to host an hour of the marathon from out in Halifax. And then as well, CJSF Radio in Burnaby or the greater Vancouver area will also be hosting 2 hours of the marathon. They're going to be doing it from right in front of Vancouver City Hall, where the Occupy Vancouver movement had been set up for the last little while. So yeah, it's really exciting too that it's not just hosted from here in Montreal, but that it's actually different stations around the country becoming way more involved in the marathon.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire from CKUW in Winnipeg. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jordan Poitras.
And I'm Ife Adigbe.
Music this week was by The Crooked Brothers and The Noble Thieves, this station's local bands.
Headlines this week were written by David Parker, Joe Bard, Ed Vaughn Andercass, and Carly Forbes. We also thank Michael Welch and Scott Price. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and the Community Radio Association.